Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group, was recorded on Monday, March 18, 2013, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Federalist Society Practice Group Courthouse Steps edition of Teleforum. Today we're going to be discussing the Arizona versus Intertribal Council of Arizona case, argued earlier today in the Supreme Court. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the expert on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We're going to hear opening remarks from our expert of about 10 to 15 minutes, followed by your questions. Eric S. Jaffe is a solo practitioner and appellate litigator here in Washington, D.C., with a practice covering a wide variety of legal issues in both state and federal courts of appeals. A substantial portion of his practice focuses on constitutional issues and litigation in the U.S. Supreme Court, so he's perfectly positioned to comment on today's argument. He's also the chairman of the Federalist Society's Free Speech and Election Law Practice Group. We're very pleased to have him here with us today. Mr. Jaffe, please go right ahead with your opening remarks.
Great. Thank you, Dean, and thank you to the Federalist Society for having me on to comment about this. So today's case, so the first argument today was Arizona versus the Intertribal Council, as Dean mentioned. For those of you not intimately familiar with the case, which I assume is presumably most of you, the case involves a requirement in Arizona that persons applying to register to vote have to provide some form of proof of their citizenship. That form of proof can take a variety of forms of proof they can provide. The simplest and easiest would be a driver's license, an Arizona driver's license number, because in Arizona, when you get a driver's license these days, they check for a birth certificate, and so much of the citizenship question is resolved at that point. But there are other forms as well. You can provide a passport number. You can provide a non-driver's ID number. You can provide certain tribal-related documents that show that you're a member of an Indian tribe, and several other things, such as a birth certificate, of course. So Arizona applied this, adopted this through, I believe it was a referendum, and they were sued by a collection of plaintiffs, including some Indian tribes and the named plaintiff, the Intertribal Council, arguing that this violated the National Voting Rights Act. So the National Voting Rights Act establishes a uniform federal registration form for voters who want to vote in a federal election. And that form is a simplified form. The law had two purposes. One purpose was to make it easier for people to register to vote by having a single form that could apply anywhere and that states would be required to, quote, accept and use, which is the statutory language that's largely at issue in this case. And another purpose of the form was to provide some checks for the integrity of election registration. So there are a variety of questions dealing with, are you a citizen? Are you 18? Do you meet various and sundry state requirements? And the form has different checkboxes and questions relating to those issues. And at the bottom, of course, you have to sign it and attest or swear that you're not lying under penalty of perjury. So it's the dual purpose of this statute is really what's at play here, given that the Arizona procedure, which requires you not merely to fill out the form, but also to provide some further information that is not required by the form itself, by the federal form itself, showing that you are indeed a citizen, not merely your attestation or your statement, your sworn statement to that effect, but some documentary proof or some numerical proof that they could then look up your passport number, for example, makes it marginally more difficult to register. It requires one more piece of information than would otherwise be required. It might require a document that you need to go hunt down or make a copy of or something of that sort. And for some small minority of people, they may not have easy access to such proof. And so the claim is that it makes it more difficult to register to vote, contrary to the simplification purpose of the NVRA. But by the same token, it increases the likelihood that Arizona would catch people who falsely attest that they're citizens when they're not citizens, since those, such people would have a more difficult time providing proof of that false attestation. And so it increases the integrity of Arizona's elections to some degree. And the lower courts considered these and found a relatively minimal burden on user registration. It found that Arizona had an important interest in making sure that only citizens voted. But at the end of the day, the Ninth Circuit ruled that the way the federal statute is worded, it suggested to the Ninth Circuit that the federal form was meant to be the exclusive set of things that you could ask of citizens seeking to register to vote, and that if asking more was contrary to the purposes of the statute. And the Ninth Circuit did this in its usual half-assed way. It started out by coming up with a whole new preemption doctrine that said in election-related cases, the normal preemption rules don't apply and there's no presumption against preemption, and all you have to do is look at the statute and see what would be harmonious, and if it's not harmonious, then it's preempted, as opposed to the traditional preemption analysis under the Supremacy Clause, which would require, would have a presumption against preemption, would require a clear statement by Congress that it is preempted. I think most people largely accept that under the traditional preemption rules, this would be a much more difficult case for the plaintiffs. It's not a slam dunk by any means, but it's certainly more difficult. And so many people, including myself, thought that much of the reason the Supreme Court took this case was to sort of smack the Ninth Circuit around in terms of this new standard of preemption that they came up with. As it turns out, in the argument, that doesn't seem to be the case. There were very few questions, I think one or two at most, regarding the Ninth Circuit's sort of goofy standard. And in fact, even the plaintiffs didn't really care much about it, their position being that under any standard, this was preempted under traditional sort of conflict and object and purpose preemption doctrine, which was just standard Supremacy Clause preemption doctrine. And the fight really was about the details of the federal statute and what Arizona is asking of folks, mostly about the federal statute. So the way the federal statute is worded is it requires a federal form, and then it sets up a new agency called the Election Assistance Commission to develop that form. And in the course of developing that form, different states can have input into the decision-making process, but the final say ultimately on what the form contains or does not contain is up to the Election Assistance Commission. Different states that have different voter registration requirements, you know, substantive voter registration requirements, such as you can't be a felon or you have to have had your rights restored or something of that sort, get to tell the Election Assistance Commission what those requirements are, and the Election Assistance Commission is supposed to incorporate such requirements to the extent that they're necessary to enable a state to determine eligibility. But at the end of the day, that's a substantially discretionary function on the part of the federal agency, and some things that get included in the form as a state-specific instruction, and some things don't. So the form has a bunch of state-specific instructions. It's not one set of questions no matter what. It's one set of questions and then 20-some-odd pages of state-specific instructions, but it's all one big federal form. And the fight in this case really got triggered because Arizona asked the Election Assistance Commission to include a state-specific instruction saying, please write in your driver's license number or your passport number or provide a copy of your birth certificate or some other form of proof. There was a list of proof. And the Election Assistance Commission said no. Actually, the Election Commission Assistance didn't say no. The executive officer of the Election Assistance Commission said no. And then when the commission itself voted, they split 2-2. But since it takes three people to do anything, that 2-2 split was effectively like a denial by an equally divided court or an affirmance by an equally divided court. So the Arizona instructions did not get added to the form. And Arizona, for some reason that was never fully explained, didn't appeal that decision. It didn't make any Administrative Procedure Act type of argument that it was unreasonable for them not to include the state-specific instructions, that it would make it difficult for Arizona to enforce its eligibility requirements or anything like that. They just sort of accepted the denial of the state-specific instruction request, and then went ahead and did what they wanted to do anyway, And so much of the oral argument, as it turns out, or much of the relevant part of the oral argument, was sort of questioning why Arizona didn't bother challenging the federal agency that is designated to make these kinds of choices. So I think probably most troubling for Arizona is very early in their argument, Justice Scalia steps up and says, why in the world didn't you make the commission add your instructions? It seems that your instructions were perfectly reasonable, but the proper process is to get them to add it to the federal form rather than just ignore the federal form and ask for something else. And there was never a satisfactory answer to that in the argument. And it, you know, in terms of Arizona's likelihood of success, it seems that Scalia's approach, which is, well, there was a perfectly good way for you to fix this problem. You could have challenged the agency. You could have claimed that they were acting arbitrarily and capriciously, and you probably could have gotten your instruction on the form at the end of the day if you brought the proper lawsuit, but you didn't, and so what are you doing here? And that speaks poorly for Arizona's chances, because while Scalia was obviously very skeptical of anything that would inevitably forbid Arizona from getting additional proof of citizenship to enforce their eligibility requirements, he didn't think this procedural approach to getting that solved was the right answer. And it looks like he would want to have it remanded and let them go challenge the Election Assistance Commission for not putting it in the form the next time around. So that didn't speak well. Justice Kennedy similarly expressed a little skepticism of Arizona's position. And given that Arizona is without question losing the four more liberal justices, you could easily see a 6-3 or even a 7-2 against Arizona based on some of the questioning. Now, that being said, Scalia and Kennedy also were somewhat skeptical of the other side's approach, which the other side has some more technical difficulties in their approach. Their argument is that the statutory requirement that you must accept and use the federal form simply means that you may not request additional information from the applicant themselves, but if you happen to have information that shows that they're lying, for example, that they're not in fact a citizen, or perhaps that they're a felon and said they weren't, that you could then, of course, deny their registration application. The difficulty with that position is the plaintiff's definition of accept and use the federal form almost inevitably implies that you have to use it to register them, and so that if you can refuse them registration based on extrinsic evidence, under their definition, you wouldn't be using the federal registration form because you'd be denying them registration based on something outside the four corners of the form. And the plaintiffs, struggled mightily to try to distinguish why this wouldn't be the case, all it means is that you can't ask the individual for more information in terms of the application being complete, but that you could always use external information in your own verification procedures if you wanted to, that didn't involve more information from the person themselves. It's a nice policy argument. It has piss little to do with the statute, but at the end of the day, it's probably the most sensible interpretation of it, because the alternative is, of course, that you have a uniform federal form that any state can ask for anything else they want, and hence there's really no point to the uniform form, because a state can have 20 further things that you have to submit, and submitting the federal form is just simply not sufficient. So there's a tension on both sides there. The statute's not terribly clear or well worded on this, and obviously given that the statute has two goals, which at times, in fact at most times, conflict, the goal of more efficient and easier registration versus the goal of integrity, those two things almost inevitably conflict. It's hard to see how one resolves that in any sensible legalistic way. If I had to make a thumbnail call on how this is going to go, Arizona loses, Scalia is probably in the majority of that, with an argument that they could do this, they just didn't do it the right way, that the way to get their requirement included would be to ask the EAC, and if the EAC refuses, to go sue them and claim that it was arbitrary and capricious, which it almost certainly would be in Scalia's view. So he may well vote against them today with a clear path for how they could win tomorrow. Hard to say what Kennedy will do, but I could easily see him joining that type of opinion. The four liberal justices will clearly say that you can't ask for more stuff, but you can go do your own background checks if you feel like. What happens with Chief Justice Roberts and with Justice Alito is a little harder. They both seem to be a little more skeptical of the position of the plaintiffs, which led to a peculiar dual system where for state registration for state elections, you could have the requirement, but you couldn't have it for federal elections. And consequently, you'd have weird dual registration, or a state would have to be put to a choice of either having the federal requirements apply to the state elections as well, or having to have a double role of qualified voters. In any event, it wasn't the most scintillating or brilliant argument in the world. Neither side made a horribly clear case of it, and I think at the end of the day, there was precious little discussion of sort of the textual meaning of the phrase accept and use, you know, either from Arizona explaining, and they tried a little bit, but it's hard to really get a strong case for why accept and use means accept it in the sense of opening up the envelope, but then refusing to register you anyway because they don't like what they see, or they don't see other things that weren't part of the form. And likewise, it's a hard road to hoe for the plaintiffs because while they say accept and use, they admit the qualification that you actually don't have to register these folks, notwithstanding what the form says, if you have a good reason to think that they're lying on the form, which has to be the policy answer, of course, but it does terrible things to their statutory construction. Anyway, that's sort of the summary of what happened today. I thought the advocates did an okay job, but neither one's really sort of locked down their case as well as they might have. And, you know, like I said, at the end of the day, based on the questioning, it doesn't look particularly favorable for Arizona. And I think you'll have a fairly narrow decision without a whole lot of discussion of this broader question of what is the preemption standard to be applied. Maybe somebody will smack the Ninth Circuit around just because it's fun. But beyond that, I can't see that being a major piece of the decision because it didn't really play a role in anybody's questions or really in anybody's answers, quite frankly. So that's my summary. I'm happy to take questions and discuss more details for anyone who has them, and let's go on with it.
Thanks very much. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that the floor mode is on. After that, if you have a question for our expert, Eric Jaffe, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for our expert today, Eric Jaffe, on the Arizona case, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got two callers with questions. Before we go to our first question, let me give you our typical, our usual announcement on upcoming programs. We've got two more Teleform conference calls scheduled for this week. On Wednesday at 2 p.m., we'll hear from two experts in a debate on the Seventh Circuit gun case. This is the case, the opinion written by Judge Posner on the concealed carry or the carrying in public statewide ban in Illinois. That's Wednesday at 2 p.m. On Thursday, also at 2 p.m., our NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, series of Teleform conference calls continues. This one on posting regulations promulgated by the NLRB. And then next week, just to give you a peek ahead at next week, the much-anticipated, highly anticipated Prop 8 and DOMA cases are going to be argued on the 26th and 27th, respectively. That's next Tuesday and Wednesday. And we will have courthouse steps editions of Teleform for each of those cases at 1 o'clock. Each of them will be next Tuesday and Wednesday, Prop 8 and DOMA. We have two callers with questions. Let's go to our first caller.
This is David Applegate in Chicago. Two questions. I'm wondering if anything was said in the argument about the statistical probability or actual statistics of anyone being prosecuted for perjury in misrepresenting that they are, in fact, eligible to vote. And second, this is more a policy question than a legal argument question, but what do you think that the president had in mind in his State of the Union address when he mentioned improving the voting experience?
Well, Let me answer the first one first, obviously. There were a couple of passing references to the issue of perjury and prosecution, mostly from Arizona, of course. So the answer was somewhat peculiar. So in discussing how they use the information on the form, if they're requiring further information to prove you're a citizen, how is it that they use the form and the attestation of citizenship? The answer was, well, if they attest to citizenship and we find out through our other mechanisms that they're lying, we prosecute them. Though it was peculiar in that the Attorney General stated that they had found hundreds of people who had falsely attested to this, but only prosecuted a handful, maybe 10 of them. Later in the argument, I think there's a possible explanation for that, which is the Attorney General sort of pointed out that most of the people falsely attesting were sort of suckered into doing so by these vote gathering and registration organizations, and that when they were called in, they freely and openly stated that they weren't citizens, and it seems that they were misled into signing anyway by folks who told them, don't worry about it, it's okay. And you can imagine that these are folks that might not have fully read the form or might have had difficulty reading the form. And so that could explain some of the non-prosecution for the signers. And then, of course, whether you would then turn around and prosecute the people doing the registration, groups like Acorn or what have you, that would presumably be under a different statute. I guess you could suborn perjury in some sense, and maybe you can derivatively get them there. But the answer at the end of the day was it sounded like very few people, even among those who in fact falsely attest, get prosecuted because there's a difficulty in showing sort of an open intent to lie. You're dealing with perhaps very unsophisticated folks, and in some instances, non-citizens or even illegal immigrants. One can understand that, certainly. There was some comment by Justice Scalia peripherally touching on this, which was to the effect that, well, it's all well and good that you have a perjury threat hanging over people to falsely testify, but presumably anybody willing to violate the voting laws in the first place and falsely vote under improper circumstances is not going to be marginally more concerned about the add-on perjury charge as well. So it doesn't do much to deter folks who have already chosen a criminal path. And I think that, of course, is right. The only thing a perjury charge, the threat of a perjury charge would do, presumably, is cause people to be more cautious in reading the form and reading the attestations. And so maybe you catch some people who might have done something by mistake, but you're very unlikely to sort of catch or prevent folks who go in with a conscious intent to violate the voting laws. As for what President Obama was thinking, I'm not Carnac the Magnificent. I wouldn't deign to guess, but based on news reports, presumably it had something to do with the long voting lines that got reported here and there and doing something to make voting either more efficient or get more ballots or get more voting machines to places where there may have been miscalculations about the demand and the timing of demand and things of that sort. But I can't imagine it has a lot to do with this case in particular, though, of course, as we've seen in other instances, why let any good public relations crisis go to waste? That's not to say he won't tack on something about this based on unrelated reports of, polls being closed early or being crowded.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have one more caller question at this point. Then our lines will be open. If you have a question for Eric Jaffe, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone.
Hey, Eric, it's Jack Park. Thanks for your report. Given that there are some other states with these statutes, I guess the answer is so long as the court doesn't clearly and unambiguously say preempted, then those states should ask the FEC for permission to do what they want to and then proceed under the APA. Is that kind of your read?
Well, I mean, that path will almost certainly be open to any state with a similar statute. There is, no matter what the court says, it will not say, nobody's even asking it to say, and even sort of the United States doesn't take the position that you can't get these kinds of things included on the form. then the United States position is simply that it's up to the EAC, the Election Assistance Commission. So every state, no matter which way this case comes out, will certainly have the option of going to the agency saying, this is my state requirement, I want you to add this extra line to the form, or add this instruction to the form that says, put in your driver's license number, put in your passport number, put in whatever it is you have, or mail in a copy of something along with your application. So that will always be open. I see zero possibility of that path being preempted. Of course, the next big fight will then be with the Election Assistance Commission, in all likelihood will say no to many of these requests, and then there will be the big APA challenge as to whether that's arbitrary and capricious, whether it improperly undermines a state's ability to enforce or to investigate its eligibility requirements, and who knows which way a court will go. I strongly suspect that if it got back up to the Supreme Court, that you would have 5 votes to say that to the extent that a state has this as part of its eligibility requirements and seeks to enforce those, it's arbitrary and capricious to deny that as an additional instruction, particularly given that other laws, the Help America Vote Act, for example, already say that you can ask for driver's license, you can ask for Social Security. There are a number of different things you can already clearly ask for. And so the additional state instruction of can you put your passport number on if you don't have any of those other things hardly seems burdensome, and hence a denial would seem quite arbitrary. No, to the extent that there's preemption, the only way preemption would happen is because it is a conflict between what the federal form says and what a state actually requires of the applicant. But as long as they got the form changed, that conflict would go away. So the conflict is really, in some sense, created by the discretionary action of the Election Admissions Commission, Election Assistance Commission, in refusing to include that as part of the form. But there's nothing that would prevent them from including that as part of the form.
So in preemption terms, it's not express, it's not implied, it's not even Hines versus Davidovits?
It's more like preemption by regulation, right? So you know, the EPA has some broad authority. They pass a regulation that says you have to do X, and some state says you can't do X. Well, that's good old-fashioned preemption, but it's the regulation that does the preempting more than the statute. It's the sort of the delegated authority that does the preempting, and this is more in that sense. It's not implied. Well, I mean, yes, it's sort of implied in this sense, but the Election Admissions Commission has taken a very clear position. I think even their regulations are clear that you may not demand more information from the applicant than what is included in the federal form. That is unquestionably so. To the extent that those regulations are upheld, then I don't see that that's different than ordinary preemption. But there is, of course, the standard administrative procedure question of whether those regulations are reasonable, whether they're arbitrary and capricious, those kinds of fights. But once you get past those fights, it's not implied anymore. In some sense, it's quite expressed. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have another question now. If you want to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button. Our lines will be open after this next question.
Good morning. This is Benny White in Tucson. I have a question about the origin of Justice Scalia's question regarding the EAC appellate process. It seems to me that grounds in ripeness or exhaustion of administrative remedies, but I don't recall that issue being raised at either the trial level or in the Ninth Circuit decision by either the majority or the dissenting opinions there. Did Justice Scalia give any indication of where that objection might have arisen?
Well, I'm not so sure it has to be characterized as a ripeness or exhaustion problem. It could just as easily be characterized as Scalia's view that, yes, in fact, the federal form is exclusive. Yes, in fact, once the form delineates what you have to provide, asking people to provide more conflicts with the federal scheme, and consequently, his view would be preemption. But his view is likewise that the solution to that problem is get them to change the form. So he's really just signaling to Arizona that you could have gotten out of this a different way. You chose not to. Now you're stuck with being preempted because the form does preempt. So it reflects not so much a this case is unripe or shouldn't be here because she didn't exhaust, but simply you lose because you didn't fix the thing that preempts you. And
but
I think that was the nature
just
of his question.
Rather curious that the EAC has not been fully seated for quite some time, and for the court to rely on that appellate process seems to be non-functional.
Well, I'm not sure it's relying on that appellate process in that sense, but I suppose if the answer is we have a bunch of things that we need to include in order to do our job as states, and if you're ineptitude as an agency and the government, the administration's ineptitude in appointing people is such that you make it impossible for us to do that, there are presumably administrative rules and certainly constitutional rules that would give some answer to that, such as you can't deny this to us because we have a right to do this under other parts of the Constitution, and if you don't have enough people to make a decision, then the decision has to be go ahead and do what you want, as opposed to, you know, we'll do what you want us to do, as opposed to we refuse to do what you want us to do, which would raise some constitutional concerns to sort of refuse a state's constitutional right to enforce its eligibility requirements simply by sort of heel-dragging, if you will, and refusing to appoint anyone. There may also be alternative means of getting a formal agency decision, even if the commission is not fully constituted. I don't know enough about the statutory scheme to know what the default rules are and how a decision gets made in the absence of a fully constituted commission, whether that's even possible. But presumably, at the point that you're imposing upon a clear state sphere of sovereignty, which is enforcing its eligibility requirements and making it impossible for them to do so, I would think there'd be quite a good constitutional or sort of quasi-constitutional claim that the inadequacies of the commission in terms of being able to answer that question don't mean that a state has to be the one that suffers. So that would be my guess as to how that kind of litigation would go, but no, none of that really got discussed at any depth. I mean, there was a passing reference to the procedural history of whether the commission, the full commission, denied Arizona's request or split 2-2. You know, as it turns out, they split 2-2 at the time, but there was very little discussion of sort of the after effects, the fact that they don't even have a quorum now, it seems to me. And Arizona didn't raise that either, because at the end of the day, I don't think that's why Arizona didn't appeal it. Right? At the time the decision was made, they had four commissioners. It's just Arizona couldn't get three. It was 2-2. So that seems to me perfectly capable of being appealed or challenged on an Administrative Procedure Act challenge. So it didn't really come up. It wasn't sort of pertinent. I appreciate the fact that if an agency is incapable of acting, how does one reconcile that where action is required to allow a state to perform its constitutional rights and duties? But that wasn't really any part of the discussion today. Certainly nobody at the court, none of the advocates made much hay about anything like that.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
We do have another caller question. If you'd like to join the queue, push the star button and then the pound button on your phone. Our lines will be open after this next caller.
Yes, David Emerson, society member here in Berkeley. Since this appears to be a fairly narrow question and along the lines of what you've described, there's other avenues of recourse from the state. I'd like to get your thoughts on why the Supreme Court decided to take on this case and speculate perhaps they were trying to nip in the bud any effort by the Ninth Circuit to create a broader sense of a preemption standard which goes beyond the context here.
You know, that is certainly what I thought in sort of my pre-argument review of the case, and I did a moot in this case, and that is certainly my sense, is that the Ninth Circuit, you know, rather than give just a simple answer following the rules, they went off the reservation and made up a bunch of crazy stuff. So yes, I before today, that's exactly what I would have said, is that that's probably why they took it, is it mattered less about what the outcome, the specific outcome was, because there are ways to fix that. But for the court, it probably mattered more that they created some crazy standard and stopped paying attention to other precedents, if you read it in that way. But I have to say, today, I saw little or no evidence of that concern, which is not to say that for some of the justices who were not particularly active in their questioning, so Chief Justice Roberts asked two or three questions. It really wasn't much. Alito asked a few. Scalia asked some, but from the other direction, most of them from the other direction, a few challenging the plaintiffs as well. And, of course, Justice Thomas didn't ask much, and Justice Kennedy asked a few cryptic questions but wasn't terribly active either. Maybe they do have that concern, and they just didn't feel any need to question the advocates about why the Ninth Circuit's wrong. You know, they don't need help on figuring that one out. Or you know, maybe the Ninth Circuit's right. It's hard to say, but my guess is if they're going to smack the Ninth Circuit around and talk about that not being the standard, they'll just go ahead and do that. It just may not change the outcome of the case, and so it didn't play a prominent role in the arguments. But you're right. Given the fact that nobody was spending much time talking about it today, it makes you wonder, and I guess at the end of the day, you take a case like this because effectively you've nullified a state law, and that in and of itself is an important decision that you should review. I mean, if you think about the cert criteria, it's not just splits. The other class of cases that often get granted are when a court strikes down a state or federal law, even if there's no split. That's sort of an important act in and of itself, and citizenship is a big deal, and the state's petitioning, and so, you know, maybe they just took it because at least at the outset, certainly at the petition stage, they thought this might have been outrageous, or at least troubling enough to warrant a second look. But to tell the truth, I didn't see any heat coming from the right side of the bench. I didn't see any sort of sense of outrage or sense of what in the world are you talking about. If anything, there was more a sense of sympathy with the position of the United States and the plaintiffs, which is, why in the world do we have a unified federal form if you get to ask them anything you want anyway? That was sort of the overall sense, and there were some less heated questions about this is a bizarre system. It makes, you know, it causes peculiarities in state registration. It seems inconsistent, but those kinds of questions seemed more like expressing frustration with Congress for writing sort of a somewhat opaque statutory scheme that may or may not make a lot of sense at the end of the day, in terms of consistency and a unified system and whatnot. But, I would not be at all surprised to have a very straightforward workmanlike decision in this case with not a ton of heat. Maybe there'll be a dissent that gets snippier, but it's hard to see. There just wasn't a lot of deep and abiding concern here. So, you know, maybe you'll get a couple paragraphs pointing out why the Ninth Circuit's crazy. That, you know, if anything, it'll be in concurrences. Maybe it'll be a majority if Roberts, you know, or somebody like that joins the majority and gets the opinion. But, you know, like I said, you know, at some point, smacking the Ninth Circuit around is just too easy, and so maybe they'll do it in an offhand kind of way, straighten out the rules for preemption and move on with things.
Our lines are now completely open. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are completely open. Let me ask you a follow-up question there, if I could.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
I take it if the court decides that Arizona improperly did not avail itself of some other procedures and therefore loses, and they do decide to smack around the Ninth Circuit, that part of the holding will or won't be binding, or does that hinge on anything? That's one part of the question. The second part of the question is, was this the Ninth Circuit, a three-judge panel or an en banc review?
It started out as a three-judge panel, which went the other way and then went en banc, and then was ultimately, I think, only two dissenters. So, and even, in fact, even the panel, Judge Kaczynski was on the panel, and he voted to uphold the law, the Arizona law. He changed his vote in en banc with the explanation that his vote at the panel level was because he was following a circuit precedent, which he thought his peers were ignoring. But once they got en banc and circuit precedent was no longer binding, he looked at the statutory language, he looked at the legislative history, and he said he thinks it's pretty darn clear that you can't ask them for more stuff. And so he voted with the plaintiffs on the en banc panel. So, you know, it's not your typical Ninth Circuit case where you maybe have one or two judges who like to thumb their nose at the Supremes. This was, you know, pretty substantial. Now, the whole circuit can occasionally get feisty, and so, you know, there's always that problem. But it's a little less typical, and particularly you have someone like Kaczynski going the same way, there's some insulation from sort of the argument that this is a left versus right kind of fight, even, you know, left versus right in terms of judicial philosophies. So that's in terms of the second part of your question. The first part of your question was what would be binding if they say you should have gone to the EAC. What would ultimately be binding, presumably if that's the answer, what the takeaway from that is that the federal form as constituted, whatever that happens to be, whatever the EAC finally decides the federal form is, that is indeed preemptive, that you cannot ask for more than what the federal form includes. You can go do your own investigations, but you can't make the applicant submit additional material beyond what the federal form specifies. That preemption holding would certainly be binding. It would be a ruling. Whether or not the opinion said anything like, well, we think it would be fairly arbitrary if they refuse to include this in the form, so you can go and bring an APA action, I have to guess that would be dicta, because, of course, you'd want to have a full development. But therefore, I'd be a little surprised if there was any strong statement of why it would be arbitrary, except maybe from Scalia. And that, of course, at the end of the day, just some signaling, but not binding a holding. And we'd have to wait for that Administrative Procedure Act to come up on the next iteration of the form, you know, when some state says, okay, change the form then. As for the sort of the standard for evaluating election law cases, you're right. Effectively, it would be dicta. If the answer is it doesn't matter which standard you applied, it still preempts. That would effectively be dicta. But, you know, once again, it's that kind of dicta that tends to carry a whole pile of weight. You know, you're one sorry lawyer if your only argument is, I know that, you know, seven justices told me no, but it was dicta. Well, you know, yeah, technically you're not going against precedent, but the odds of your winning that one, and certainly in a lower court, are not very high, where the Supreme Court has given an extremely strong signal of how it views the law. So, yes, as a technical answer, it might not be binding, but as a practical matter, it would certainly influence most cases that follow it.
Good. Once again, our lines are open. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. And while we're waiting to see if there are more questions, let me ask you one other question, Eric, and that is, you mentioned that I think, as you described them, four liberal justices were decidedly on the other side against Arizona. Were you basing that on their previous jurisprudence or
questions they asked
during the argument? Or?
Yes, on questions they asked. So Justice Sotomayor, right out of the, was the first questioner and the first and heavy questioner, and she was basically giving Arizona all kinds of grief. There was no ambiguity in terms of her views on what she thought about Arizona's arguments. Justice Ginsburg followed shortly thereafter. Justice Kagan followed shortly thereafter. So those three basically spent a good chunk of the Attorney General's argument sort of giving him lots of grief without a lot of ambiguity as to which way they thought. Justice Breyer sort of held fire for quite a while, but ultimately sort of, I think, showed his hand in questioning the plaintiffs, so the respondents, in that all of his questions were something like, well, your opponents say X, Y, and Z. I would think you'd have a pretty strong answer to that, wouldn't you? What is it? You know, it was a series of those questions where he'd repeat the other side's argument in a way that suggested he didn't think much of it, and then invite the respondent's attorney to take a shot. And if he didn't like the shot the respondent's attorney took, he'd invite her to do it again just to make sure she took a better shot, because he had his own little theories and he wanted her to endorse them so that he could say they argued it. It was pretty clear he had a handful of theories as to why he thought Arizona should lose, and spent most of his time trying to get respondent to adopt them, which, you know, they didn't actually always do, but and to their credit, which they didn't just jump on that. But at the end of the day, I don't think his inclinations were particularly difficult to discern. And once again, it's all just from the questioning, not from any prior jurisprudence.
Sure. Thank you for clarifying that. Looks like we're out of questions. We've got a few more minutes. Let me see if you have any final thoughts you want to wrap up.
Well, I guess my only final thoughts on this are, if I think Arizona has a difficult problem in terms of construing the statutory language that says you have to accept and use the federal form. And while there is a linguistic argument and a linguistic approach out there that says accept and use doesn't mean that you have to get to the final result of actual registration. And the examples they give are not bad, you know. So I can accept and use credit cards, but it doesn't mean I can't ask you for a driver's license to make sure that you're actually the person whose name is on the credit card. I can accept and use cash as a form of payment for beer, but it doesn't mean I don't get to ask you for proof of age also. And so in that linguistic world, accept and use I guess means you can accept it as a necessary component, but not necessarily a sufficient component, or as at least a partly sufficient component. But I have to say, in this context, in the application for registration context, it doesn't ring as persuasive as it does in other contexts where you have to accept and use a federal form for registration. It strongly implies that that means that the form is sufficient, not merely necessary. And if it didn't mean that, it would lead to a peculiar world in which the federal form was sort of a passing suggestion. And maybe the federal form sets up a minimum standard of information beyond which you could go above. And so there are arguments there, but what Arizona really needs at the end of the day is a very strong version of the anti-preemption presumption in order to sort of get the rest of the way. And so at some level, I actually think the Ninth Circuit's jurisprudential argument about what the standards are for preemption really is more important here, because if you sort of buy into Arizona's worldview of the old-fashioned preemption jurisprudence, which gives states a massive benefit of the doubt and really requires a very clear statement from Congress, and any ambiguity is construed against preemption, then Arizona probably survives this. But I have a strong sense that even if the Supreme Court rejects the Ninth Circuit's sort of weak, loosey-goosey version of it, they are certainly not going to apply the same strong presumption against preemption that you may find in other contexts where you're preempting a state's health and safety laws, for example. I just don't see them applying it that rigorously as you occasionally see them applying it in other contexts. In large part, I think, because this law, of course, deals with federal elections, and while it's true that states get to determine who's a qualified voter even for federal elections, the extremely strong federal interest in sort of ease of federal elections and getting people to vote in federal elections, I think would sort of temper the strength of the presumption against preemption and allow a greater latitude of preemption if there was any sense of conflict or messing up the federal scheme. And so in sort of old-fashioned terms, this would be called sort of object and purpose preemption, which a number of members of the court have sort of discussed with reasonable contempt over the years. Object and purpose preemption is not very rash. It's not a very coherent approach to preemption, but it's well-established in the law, and even some of the conservative justices routinely apply it. And so here you might see sort of a broader sense of what the objects and purposes are and what might interfere with those objects and purposes. At the end of the day, I'm not sure you're really going to have that kind of high-level jurisprudential discussion about sort of where does the presumption lie and how strong is the presumption, rather than a more sort of case-specific, boy, it really seems like Congress meant to have this be the one form, and without necessarily a ton of discussion about how we get there from a jurisprudential perspective. That's just my gut, you know, and my gut has been wrong lots of times before, but it would be nice to see some kind of clarity there. I don't think we'll get it. I think we'll probably get just sort of a backhanded swipe at the Ninth Circuit for making stuff up and being a little too loosey-goosey without necessarily a very clear alternative from the Supreme Court, because, of course, even saying we apply traditional preemption standards is not very clear, given that traditional preemption standards are inconsistently applied across the range of cases. So that's something to look at when the opinion finally comes down to see whether they add any clarity to that area. I don't expect there to be much, to be honest. And even if they said something strong in one direction or another, it wouldn't really help the overall preemption analysis in other cases that much, because so many of those preemption cases are sort of fact-specific and sort of temperament-specific and composition of the majority specific in any event. And you'll always have some disagreement between, you know, the more conservative and the more liberal justices as to how strong or weak preemption should be in any given case. So go pick a principle from nine people who don't exactly agree on what the standard ought to be, even if they agree on the result in any given case. And that's really the only final thoughts I have on it, other than, you know, it would be, I thought the advocates did a nice job, but not a great job. And so I'm not sure they helped the court one way or the other in terms of how they were going to resolve this. I don't think this oral argument necessarily moved the dime that much.
Very good. Well, Eric Jaffe, thank you so much for attending argument today and for joining us on the call today. We certainly appreciate your insights to our audience. I remind you that you're invited to join us for our next Teleforum conference call Wednesday at 2 p.m. Eastern at the same number, when we'll be discussing the recently decided Seventh Circuit gun case. But until then, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.